Hello, and welcome to Conversations with Lee Fulkerson, a series of podcasts from Plant Pure Nation. I'm Lee Fulkerson, and my guest today is Doug Michael. Mr. Michael is the owner and founder of Columbia County Bread and Granola, a very successful producer of plant-based foods. He started out as a cartoonist, writing and illustrating graphic novels for DC Comics and Fantagraphics books, He also read manuscripts for the literary department at the William Morris Agency. In 2007, he developed a successful recipe for sprouted grain bread. He soon expanded his efforts to include a salt-free, oat-free, flax-based granola. Today, Columbia County Bread and Granola is a small but highly dedicated company of bakers, packers, designers, an office staff, and a retail outlet called Baker's Guild Cafe. So welcome to the show, Mr. Michael.
Thank you very much, Lee. Appreciate it.
You got it. So how and when did you become a writer and cartoonist?
Okay, so there's a story to that. And because I had no intention of becoming either a cartoonist or a baker, but cartoonist came first, and it just wasn't something I was expecting to happen in my life. But I was raised in a very conservative, white, middle-class suburban home in Columbus, Ohio. My family was and still is staunchly conservative. My mother was a born-again homemaker. My father ran an insurance company and was active reserves in the military. Mm-hmm. So anyway, by the time I got to college at Ohio State, I had some vague idea of going into advertising. I think ideally I was hoping to pattern my life after Darren Stevens from the TV show Bewitched. And that's pretty much my ambition in life. But just in case, I remember getting my insurance license as a fallback, of course. Anyway, I think I was what you probably would call a work in progress at that time. But then one day I was in class. It was a giant lecture hall, and my pen was in my jacket pocket, and it exploded, and it completely ruined my jacket and my shirt, and it left this big, blotchy ink stain directly over my heart. And so I drove home that day thinking my mom could help salvage the jacket, but she wasn't home, so I left the jacket with a note, and I drove back to campus. But by the time I got to my apartment, my roommate was there to meet me, and of course, you knew instantly in those situations that something terrible has happened, and he explained that my mom had died in a car accident. The timing was just eerily coinciding with my exploding pen. Well, that event alone was chilling, and it was a crushing personal loss, but I was not in any way prepared for what would happen next. Because a year after the accident, my father left for Brazil to get away, as he told us. He wanted to go to Rio to the beach at Ipanema. And, you know, who could blame him? I mean, it seemed like a good idea. But anyway, before he returned, he called and he said he was bringing a friend home with him. And I remember my whole family kind of sitting around speculating that he would have some Buxton Brazilian hottie in tow. But we were introduced to Jose, a young man about my age at that time. He was definitely a nice guy, but, you know, this wasn't what any of us were expecting. So I was like, okay, that's cool. And I would go and I would visit my father and his new friend. But Jose's English was very halting and broken at best, and my dad had a hearing problem. It's hard of hearing. And so listening to these two attempts at conversation would just crack me up. And I got pretty good at mimicking the two of them to my roommates at school. But, you know, they're like, Doug, you do realize your dad is gay, right? And I remember struggling with that, but there it was. I mean, I had to admit that he actually seemed genuinely happy in this new relationship of his. And I could then look back and I could see that so many of the things about my dad that I didn't understand about him growing up, his sense of frustration at little minor things and even anger and boiling over rage over things that just seemed trivial at the time. I think they were all rooted in his having to play a role in hiding his truth from the world. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was as if this entire veneer of everything I had grown up in, believing, the thinking I believed in or knowing about who I was and what I understood about life and what was normal and what was real had just been stripped away. It felt as if I'd stepped through something that allowed me to see the world differently. And in the way it really was, with all its complexities and, you know, hidden hypocrisies, as opposed to the way I was raised to believe the world to be, particularly someone like me who came from such a rigid, gender-specific, white bread family. Right. So my response to all that conflicted emotionless. I felt this real need to create, to draw, to write, to do something that would allow me to explore this new understanding of the world and how I felt about it. And what generally came out, you know, were these crude drawings, probably pretty cynical, somewhat dark, critical of the kind of society we live in. But that is what essentially set me on the path to becoming a cartoonist.
What a story. And
yeah.
That's amazing, man. I'm glad I asked the question, and that's incredible.
I haven't really talked about this other than in, you know, dinner table kind of conversations with friends. So this is the first time I've ever really gone into any detail.
Well,
about.
I thank you for sharing it, because it is really insightful, and it really does give you a really interesting perspective, I'm sure, you know, on life. It must have been, you know, of course, it shattered a lot of stuff that you had grown up with, but to be able to deal with it in the way that you did, I think was probably really helpful to you. I hope it was,
yeah.
Anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's great. I mean, you know, people deal with things in different ways. You know, some people would start drinking heavily, maybe, or, you know, become a drug addict, or become violent, or whatever. But you found an outlet in being an artist, which I think is actually, you know, really, really cool. So
yeah,
it
certainly helped give me a focus.
Well, that's fantastic. What was the subject matter of your graphic novels?
So after college, I went to art school because I really, like I said, my work was rather crude. But I studied anatomy, studied structural drawing, and tried to get those basic skills into my skill set. Anyway, one of my instructors felt I had something, apparently. So he took my portfolio to the Columbus Dispatch, which was the main newspaper for Central Ohio. In fact, I used to deliver it as a paperboy when I was a little kid. And lo and behold, they hired me. And basically, I started out doing spot illustrations. But that led to my first big job as a cartoonist, which was to write. This was something I suggested to them. I wanted to write and illustrate a 9-part history of the state of Ohio in a continuing double-page spread in their Sunday magazine of the Columbus Dispatch. I mean, this was a pretty big deal. The Columbus Dispatch,
yeah.
Has, you know, I mean, it's declined over the years, but back then it was a major newspaper for Columbus, Ohio, and much of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So I dived into that one, and, you know, there were no sacred cows. I skewered everything I could think of, including the greatest sacred cow of all, which is Woody Hayes in Ohio State football. So when the series ended, I would never hear back from the Columbus Dispatch. I mean, there's just no more contact, and I'm afraid perhaps the editor who hired me was either demoted or fired. But that got me an interview with HarperCollins, the book publisher, amazingly. So I traveled to New York. I got an offer to write and illustrate, you know, some of those cartoon guidebooks that were kind of big in the 80s, a cartoon guide to this or that topic. And so signed on. I took that advance. I moved to New York City, and after those books were done, I did a series of comic books for DC Comics. I did some work for the National Lampoon, which I grew up reading and loving, and the Village Voice, pretty much any paper magazine that hired cartoonists, except the New Yorker, which is one publication that couldn't seem to crack. But anyway, I should mention, I have posted a sample of one of my shorter narrative cartoons on our website. The link is at the end of my bio, if anybody's curious to see what sort of work I did.
Well, you should go ahead and plug your website now, too, by the way.
Oh.
Let us know.
Yeah, okay. That is ColumbiaCountyBread.com.
Great.
And there's a link down to About Us or our company, I believe. And then you'll see a little bio of all our employees. And at the end of mine, there's a link to a cartoon.
Well, I'm definitely going to go there and check out the cartoon, because I find this absolutely fascinating. So, you know, okay, now from that, when and why did you become a convert to plant-based nutrition? I mean, this, you know, it seems kind of incongruous, but maybe not.
Right. Well, okay. All right. So there's a story. First off, what I discovered as a cartoonist in the 80s and 90s is that publishing world was changing dramatically. A lot of newspapers and magazines were folding left and right. Pay scales were dropping. it just seemed like the whole print industry was in a steep decline. So I know that there was a period then when I must have been thinking about a career change, but I absolutely had no idea what that might be. I mean, I just never really figured that out. But anyway, my wife at the time, she and I moved out of New York City to this bucolic little town called Bedford. It was about an hour north of Manhattan. And we found this little itty-bitty hovel house amid these massive estates and horse farms. So the first thing we did was to get a dog, of course. And I took this dog for a long walk. There were horse trails that wound through these incredible estates and horse country. And amazingly, you know, it's this kind of area where you'd run into people like Richard Gere or Bobby Kennedy Jr. And incidentally, Bobby Kennedy and I became buds that summer. And I do have some stories to tell about that, but not now. But however, if you go to the link on my bio, the cartoon that's there was something I did for his publication, The Waterkeeper. So Anyway, on one of those dog walks, I got bit by a tick. And, of course, I got Lyme disease. And so right away I went on antibiotics, didn't seem to do much. I went on another course of antibiotics, didn't really seem to do much. And I, you know, just had achy joints, headaches, a lot of the sort of mysterious things that crop up with Lyme. Well, that was when a friend recommended I look into diet as a means of regulating these symptoms. And one of the things she did for me, she gave me a copy of Sally Fallon's cookbook, Nourishing Traditions. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic book. It's filled with excellent dietary guidance. And that book then led me to the Weston Price Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe your listeners know this, but for those who don't, Weston Price was a dentist back in the 1930s out of Cleveland, Ohio. And he noticed that his patients arriving from Eastern Europe had perfect teeth and were in great health. But within a year of adapting to a Western industrialized diet, their teeth started to decay and their health began to decline. So he apparently had the resources to shutter his practice, and he traveled the world to study traditional non-industrial cultures and their diets. And basically he came back, and he and the foundation advocated for a number of things. But what I took note of was that if you're going to eat grain, it needs to be prepared for digestion through the process of sprouting and or fermentation. Mm-hmm. This is what all pre-industrial cultures did, and I've seen evidence that this is true of ancient cultures as well, that the Egyptians sprouted grain. And we all know that the Jews leavened their bread in a process that took 3 days because of Passover and the decision to make unleavened bread. And we also know that the Bible contains a passage on how to prepare sprouted grain bread, Ezekiel. And then there was the early Christian sect, the Nicene, who were famous for their sprouted grain bread. So I took interest in that and went out looking for sprouted breads, Ezekiel being probably the best known. Now, at this point, I wasn't a baker. I was just a consumer. And really, the thought of baking this bread absolutely did not occur to me until sometime shortly after the events in my life happened.
Well, did your health improve as a result of changing your diet?
Well, I can tell you now definitively, yes, that I don't show any outward signs of Lyme. I mean, I don't have those mysterious rashes or the achy joints, the headaches. Those have all disappeared. And can I directly correlate those two? I don't know, but I don't suffer from symptoms of Lyme anymore.
Well, that's great. So Lyme's disease is kind of a chronic thing that can affect people for years then, or actually be permanent. Is that the case? I don't know that much about the disease.
Yeah, I think it affects everybody in different ways. I know that sometimes, I mean, I've talked to people who have very, very severe conditions from Lyme. I think that mine were relatively minor, but at the same time, they were problematic. I mean, you know something's wrong, and it seems to be like an opportunistic disease where when you're already feeling lowly or maybe you're a little sick, then these symptoms have a way of creeping up.
Your immune system is vulnerable or something like that.
Yeah. So anyway, I can say that, no, I really haven't had to deal with symptoms of Lyme for quite a while. And that may be just not just a sprout of grain breads, but basically just adhering to a whole food diet. Eliminating a lot of the things that I think impact your health in a negative way.
Oh, glad to hear it. I hate to hear about anybody suffering these chronic diseases that are mysterious, like, you know, lupus or fibromyalgia or anything like that. These things are really have a terrible impact on people's lives, and I'm glad to hear that you're over your symptoms, because I'm sure that had a really bad impact on your life. So,
and nobody really wants to take antibiotics. I don't think. I mean, I think that's really like a last resort for treating, you know, some of these illnesses. And, but that's
sure.
what they were using at that time for Lyme's. And I think that, in a sense, takes as much out of you as a disease.
Yeah, I'm sure it can. And is the disease even bacterial in the first place? Is
exactly.
it viral? Or,
right.
I mean, if it's viral, I mean, what's the point of taking antibiotics in the first place? I mean, I don't know. It seems like that, you know, doctors throw antibiotics at just about everything. You know, you go in, you're sick for something, and they throw an antibiotic at you.
Right, unfortunately, right.
It's not a it could be – if it's a viral disease, then the antibiotic isn't going to do any damn good in the first place. So, anyway, so how and why did you make the leap from your original career into then baking bread?
Yes, okay. So, you know, as I look back on it now, it seems rather inevitable, but at the time it just felt like these series of events that were in many ways tragic, but that moved me in a particular direction. And and basically I just kind of followed what opened up to me. So I think going back to the summer of 2001, my life completely unraveled when my wife left me unexpectedly, and she took my daughter and my dog with her back to Ohio. And I would eventually try to make a new life for myself back in Ohio to be with my daughter, but I simply couldn't do it for very long. For one, my father was now living with another young Brazilian man about my age, and I felt like I just wasn't ready to leave New York. I had a lot of friends there, and it was really the only work that I was sort of good at.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my friends in New York was a divorce attorney, so she was helping with my divorce, and she knew I had to move out of my house in Bedford, so she offered me her Manhattan apartment as a sublet. She was living in the Hamptons and would only stop by on rare occasions, so, you know, yeah, perfect. I'll take that deal. So I moved in, and this was late summer 2001. I was still very depressed, still very emotionally torn up inside when I woke up on one of those very beautiful September mornings and watched in utter disbelief as the Twin Towers came down.
Okay.
And so suddenly my little wave of grief, you know, just felt like it had gotten lost in this ocean of despair that was everywhere. And I remember that time as being, you know, I just stayed in bed. I mean, weeks would go by, very difficult to sleep. I really wasn't doing much work, and I was really struggling to figure out how I was going to pull out of all this darkness that I was feeling. Anyway, for whatever reason, I can remember sitting at my kitchen table one morning cooking a slice of Ezekiel bread, and I just got to wondering, like I would about any number of things, if I could make this kind of sprouted grain bread. But for whatever reason, that little moment of curiosity became an obsession. I mean, just like, I got to figure this out. And that helped, you know. It pulled me out of my funk. It pulled me out of my misery. Unfortunately, I had no training as a baker, and there were really very few available recipes out there on how to make this kind of bread.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I struggled, but I kept at it over time. And I sprout grain, grind it up, try this, try that. It was just something that went on for weeks, months, years even, and all the trial and error, admittedly mostly error. You know, I'd get these gooey, soggy loaves time and time again, dense, gummy bread. I'm trying to convince myself that I could figure it out. But each time I think maybe I learned one little thing and kind of kept track and just tried to stay with it.
Perseveres. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
So then how long did it take before you perfected the recipe?
I would love to answer that question definitively, but I honestly can't say. My bakers who work with me today, Ian and Bill, we struggle still. I mean, this is a bread that humbles us, because even though we pretty much do everything always the same way. This process that we finally ultimately figured out has resulted in great bread.
Mm-hmm.
We often get different results. What I can tell you is that, you know, we have made the decision to partner with nature to make this bread. And so we expect variations, and those variations can come about from just, I mean, like ambient temperature of the room, humidity level from week to week, and an approaching storm front will have an impact. Changing seasons, we're always, you know, anticipating that and what that's going to do. So it impacts that ability to pull out what we think is just that perfect loaf of bread that we're always after. And we do get there, but not always. And we have to accept that, you know, that's just the way it's going to be. But I will say this. I mean, there are critical aspects to making flourless, naturally leavened sprouted grain bread, which is what we do. And one of those is catching that grain just after it sprouts. When that grain shows, it shows a little small radicle, what they call radicle. It's the beginning. It's a tip, the beginning of the emerging root system. And when it shows that, we know that that grain has come to life. And we know that there are tremendous events happening inside that grain. And of course, then that's when we get to work with that grain to turn it into bread. Also critical to our process is adding salt. Not a lot. A relatively very small amount, but knowing when that salt is introduced into the dough and how is just one of the keys for us to making this dough work. And I just want to mention that for that bit of insight and many others, I have to thank Michael Progovich, who was my initial principal baker that worked with me. And he was just some guy I hired, and for the simple reason that he lived close by. But somehow he took my obsession and took it away and kind of made it his own. And just, he was a lucky hire because he's one of those guys who had a mind for detail and an eye toward very careful observation. And he took my recipe and he just worked and labored and thought about every step and every aspect of what was happening and basically refined it. And I think due to him, we had something now that is potentially a world-class loaf of bread.
Well, I got to say, you were kind enough to send me a package of some of the foods you produce, including the bread, and the bread is really good. I mean, so I don't know, you know, whether the batch I got was, you know, a top loaf or a medium loaf or whatever it was, but it's damn good, and it, you know, so you've done a hell of a job, and your team. Yeah. So what caused you to start producing other products besides the bread?
Okay, so there's a happy story here. But ironically, you know, it's fascinating about our sprouted grain breads. We also make granola. It's a flax-based granola.
Mm-hmm.
And it is by far our best-selling product. But anyway, the reason I came to that is I got interested in flax seeds. Because, you know, a lot of times when we make our dough, it can be wet, and it can be a little sloppy and hard to work with. So I was looking at flax as a means of maybe drawing out some of that moisture. And that worked really well. It actually worked a little too well because the dough is just too tight and dense. But I just got very interested in flax at that point and realized that, you know, this is an amazing food. I mean, it's something that you should absolutely include in your diet in some way. It's by and large, it's known as a superfood. It's nutrient dense. It's rich in anti-inflammatory properties. It's high in omega-3s. It's got soluble and insoluble fiber. I mean, the list goes on. So I started playing around with flax, and I basically came up with this granola. I mean, the thing about flax is when it gets wet, it secretes a resin-type substance, and so they just kind of naturally come together into these granola-type bites. Which I thought was kind of perfect, and of course I was wondering why nobody else is making something like this, and was this something I wanted to make? So there I was. I was pondering these things when but I have to say it's one of those strange anomalies that seem to defy all logic. It somehow governs my life. Struck again. At that time, I had left New York altogether, and I was living in a small college town in Pennsylvania with my new girlfriend, and I was baking this bread out of my home kitchen, and I was selling it at the local farmer's market right around the corner. And anyway, one of my regular customers came up to buy some bread, and I just remember that day he was extremely excited. Something great had just happened. He had met this girl online, and they were dating, and he was telling me that she was a fitness nut and a nutritionist, and she was in New York City, and he was off to see her that weekend, and he just wanted to know if I had anything else he could take with him for her. And at the time, he wasn't sure if she really liked bread or not. So I just happened to have some of this flax granola on me, and this stuff that I wasn't sure what I was going to do with, but I told him he could take it, and she's a nutritionist, see what she thinks.
Uh-huh.
A few weeks later, she calls me out of the blue, and it turns out that this nutritionist that was dating my friend, my customer, was Lynn Janae. Lynn Janae famously went on to write a New York Times bestseller around her concept that she calls the plan. And at that time, she was years away from the success, but she knew that she was looking for someone who might be making this a flax-based granola, because she knew that a flax-based granola would be just elemental in helping people lose weight and helping them identify foods that they might be otherwise reactive to.
Mm-hmm.
So here she is looking for someone who might be making this product and having no success, when this guy she's dating from a small town in Pennsylvania hands her a little bag of it. So she calls, and she comes to Pennsylvania, and we meet, we sit down, and she tells me, what she's working on and what she's trying to do, and asked me to adapt the recipe to kind of fit what she was looking for, and I absolutely agreed to do that. And essentially, it was this flax granola, but without any oats, no sugars, aside from molasses, and no salt, and then some spices like cinnamon for flavor. So it was a real basic, simple recipe. But anyway, I started packaging it, selling it to her clients, and her business grew. I mean, her client list grew, and a lot of her clients were people in the people in the television industry. I mean, people that kind of helped her along in her career. And so then she published the book, and then she went on the Dr. Oz show to promote the book. And during that show, the two of them sat down and they sampled the flax granola. Well, literally overnight, my business went from myself, my principal baker, Michael, and a couple other guys who were working with us part-time to having very nearly 30 employees full-time cranking out night and day. I mean, it was an incredible time, but, I had no idea then, but it really only lasted a few months before it just started to ebb off, and the Dr. Oz crowd, moved on to whatever the next big thing was. But fortunately, we had captured just enough of a following to really keep us busy and then grow slowly from there.
Mm-hmm.
And we also identified, in this hiring sport, some really great guys. I mean, some people that we absolutely wanted to hang on to. And so that became the basis of our company.
Yeah, that's fantastic. The next question was, what were the breakthroughs that made your business successful? But you
Right. And beyond the individuals and events I've already discussed, I find that everyone who currently works with me brings something beyond simply helping me with these bakes or with packaging or whatever. All the guys are highly creative in some way. I mean, this is a small town, and there are not a lot of opportunities out here. Most of the guys that work for me probably would have ended up, if they had a father who was in the trades, if not, they might end up working at a bar. But industry is not that, it's all moved out throughout much of the country. It's been moved out to other countries. So, but these are really smart kids, and they're bright, they're creative, and I encourage that. In our company, we have our own in-house print shop where we brand all our boxes, we screen print all our packaging, and we think this is really important. The fact that there are imperfections when you look at your package and you look at the one just like it, there are differences, and it just conveys a sense that this was something
individually
done
crafted
by real humans, And that's the message we want to convey. We are individuals preparing food for other individuals. I mean, that's how
puts the capital A in artisan, so to speak.
Yeah. So we try to carry that idea over into everything we do, and I think it gets expressed in our videos and our messaging and website, et cetera. As for myself, I think the one job I won't turn over to anybody else is customer service. I make a point to respond to all emails that come in, and I try to sign my name to all orders that go out. If you call us, I'm generally the one who answers the phone, and I try to do a follow-up with every order just to make sure you know, you got what you ordered and you're satisfied. I have a policy with respect to customer complaints that is very simple, and I basically ask myself how I would like to be treated. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think like most people, I just want to know that there's an individual at that company who will pick up the phone and deal with the problem as it is the only thing they have to deal with that day. And that's pretty much how I operate. And to me, honestly, there's really no one single thing that a company can do to achieve success more important than listening to your customers.
Yeah, that's really progressive, but it's, I mean, it's very basic and old-fashioned in a way, but it's like something that was lost, I think, in our mass culture, and it's great to hear it coming back. And
yeah, it is coming back. I think you're right about that.
Yeah. Give me an overview of the products you produce now. I mean, I've certainly had a sampling of several of them, and they're all good, but why don't you tell us about them?
Okay, yeah, sure, thank you. We offer four basic types of flax granola. We have a couple other varieties that maybe are seasonal or come in and go out or whatever, and we're trying to develop some new varieties, but basically we have four varieties of flax granola. We bake this flourless, naturally leavened bread. With that, we do a pita, pocket pita. And
we also do
a pizza shell. I'm sorry?
I love the pita bread.
Thank you. Yeah. It's my absolute favorite of everything we do. It's pita.
It's really cool, man.
Yeah. You know, and again, it's just, well, I'll get to the recipe, but a lot of what we do goes to our cafe. We have a small cafe in town where we retail our products out of. And then we ship, you know, we ship to all over the country. But I would say the bread is just too perishable to put in stores because it's, you know, it's got to have more than 5-6 days of shelf life. And we don't see that happening. So our goal with the bread is just get it directly into the hands of consumers as quickly as we can. But anyway, because of that perishability issue, we also make a flatbread, which is essentially the same dough. We roll it very thin and squeeze a lot of the moisture out, and then we bake it. And so that product will last quite a long time. And that's, as we look forward to the future of what this company can be, we think that we can really do something with that flatbread. But, you know, I mean, for a long time I've been reluctant to put any of our products in store shelves because, for one, you know, you give up most of your margin to distributors and brokers and store chains, and two, I mean, the grocery store business is, you know, it's extremely cutthroat.
It is
very competitive, and I think that most food manufacturers, you know, they will stake everything on getting that big contract, getting into the big chain stores, only to find then that they lack the resources to properly promote their products, and then there's a real danger of just withering on the shelf. So, you know, for every new product that comes into the store, some's getting pulled off. So it's, you know, it's risky, but I think our strategy will be to go about that very gradually. If we do work with stores, we want to be sure that they're within, say, 2-hour drive, so we can get there and we can sample and we can talk directly to customers about what we do. Otherwise, you know, I'm very comfortable with our current model, which is just baking this. If you order from us online, we'll ship to you next day or 2 days, and that works pretty well. Plus, we have our cafe that works real well for us.
Fantastic. So, do you still do any writing or drawing?
Well, yes. I am working on a book about what it's like to start and run a business when you have absolutely no training and no real idea on how to run or manage a business. I mean, there's a lot I can talk about. But I can probably characterize it in a few words, which is it's challenging. It can be highly stressful and all-consuming. But, you know, the other side of that is can be incredibly rewarding, and I just feel very lucky that I found the people that were attracted to work with me, and I just find them to be very smart, very dedicated to what we're doing, and very hardworking. And you know, I just like to say this: with the exception of my bookkeeper, everybody who works for me is young. I mean, they're in their 20s, And I hear it all the time from people my age who say that young people today don't want to work, that they're lazy, they feel entitled, they just want to watch movies or whatever. And I want to say emphatically that that has not been my experience at all. I mean, I see these 20-year-olds as really bright, very motivated, curious to learn. They want to be challenged, you know, and I think that the critical difference for getting young people motivated and engaged is that you offer them a job that has a purpose, that makes sense to them because it has benefits for others and it makes them feel good and needed and necessary. And then you simply have to give them some space to make discoveries about what they're capable of.
Exactly. Give them some scope to do to develop themselves, you know?
Yeah, and you know, and they hold me to task to do my end. You know, and they're very, very dedicated to what we're doing and doing it well. And I honestly couldn't be happier with the company that we have. But anyway, that concept is very central to how I feel about running a business, and that as this business grows, I hope to be in a position where I can help my employees invest in this business if they want to, or we can help them if they choose to take their talents and start their own business. I feel I'm very much about that, about helping people find and create their own path to financial security. And you asked if I'm still drawing. For instance, if you order from us and you're sending our products as a gift to a friend or whomever, I'll happily draw a gift card.
I love it. A homemade gift card from the CEO. I think that is beyond cool. You really have a great, 21st century business here going, dealing with like the oldest food item in civilization, which I think is a really cool kind of a juxtaposition of elements. So it's fantastic. What about gluten-free breads and stuff like that?
I do have some thoughts on that. What I wanted to say about that is that, so there's a lot of discussion now about grain.
Yeah.
You know, is grain healthy or not?
Yeah.
And if so, you know, how do you defend it? And if not, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's the way I respond to that. I think grain is healthy. It's incredibly healthy. The discovery of agriculture, that is, the discovery that grain could be collected, planted, cultivated, harvested, I feel it has to rank as the single most important discovery by our species. I mean, nothing else even comes close. And nearly everything we know today stems from that one single discovery.
Yeah.
And here's why. If you think about it, every last
civilization.
Last proto hominid. I'm sorry.
Every civilization there existed, you know, is a result of agriculture.
Right. Every previous proto-hominid species, from Paleos and Neanderthals, Homo erectus, they all came and went, you know, because they didn't they ate grain. I mean, we know that. The idea that Paleos didn't eat grain is not supported by the facts. Paleos ate grain whenever they could find it.
Of course they could. It's not easy to hunt, you know, and you don't get a wildebeest every day, you know what I mean? It takes time and effort to get one of those. And
for the most
part, they're eating the other stuff. The hunting and gathering societies, the emphasis was definitely on the gathering. The hunting was supplemental, in my opinion.
Yeah, and those cows have a tendency to charge back. And I'm sure it was not like catching a chicken today. I mean, completely different atmosphere. But, they ate grain. They just didn't have the wherewithal to think that, let's not eat it all. Let's save a little bit, and we'll put it in the ground, and we'll cultivate it. That's what our ancestors did. And I think importantly, you know, one of the first discoveries they made was that, hey, ferment this. If you ferment this grain, it allows you to do two things. You can make alcohol and you can make bread.
Mm-hmm.
And right. So And at the same time, they discovered you could store grain, you know, for future use.
Yeah.
I mean, and that meant humans weren't condemned to wander in an endless search for food. I mean, it meant communities could form and rise up, and families could be established, and children could be nurtured. And from that came language and culture and civilization. I'm getting on my soapbox, but don't forget the storage
no,
of grain.
No, but believe me, I'm with you 100% on this. I mean, it drives everything I believe about prehistory too. It's just agriculture was it allowed us to, have leisure time and do other stuff besides worrying about getting food all the time. So, it art and architecture and literature and everything else.
Exactly. Think about this. I mean, when we started stockpiling grain, we had to manage those stockpiles. We had to know what was in there and how it was being. And that led to the discovery of math. I mean, across multiple civilizations.
I believe
the concept of religion, philosophy, higher thought all came from experimenting with alcohol, the fermentation of grain. So, on a very real sense, I think we owe almost everything to grain. To wheat, if you want to be more specific.
Yeah.
And so when people
want
to tell me that grain is unhealthy, no, I'm sorry, get real.
I know.
Here's another thing. When we stockpile grain, we discovered the cats were an incredibly useful animal to protect our grain.
Yep.
And I know because I've got two cats here at the house. So what I'm saying is if you have a cat today and you love that cat, I think you need to take a moment right now and thank wheat. Because cats had absolutely no interest in humans until we started stockpiling grain, and mice started coming around, and cats.
That's right. That's right. And that's why cats were sacred to Egyptians. It's because they helped guard the granaries. So killing a cat. If you killed a cat in ancient Egypt, it was a very, very serious offense, by the way. But anyway, that's just a sidebar. But cats are really, really important.
So. With respect to how we look at wheat specifically for this bread, I can tell you that I believe wheat is a miracle grain. It is the miracle grain, simply because I can't think of any other grain that I can take, and simply by soaking it in water, I can make bread. And so how does that work? All right. Everything I need is right there on that grain of wheat. For instance, I don't need to add yeast. I don't need to open up a package of yeast and throw it in because yeast molecules have already attached themselves to the grain husk. And by soaking the grain, I begin the process of fermentation. The first thing that happens is the grain's outer shell, the bran, starts to separate into seven distinct layers. And those layers provide all the fiber and soluble fiber the body needs. And once the water reaches the endosperm, that seventh layer enters the endosperm, it is dramatically altered. The bran signals to the endosperm is no longer grain, it is a living plant. So now all that starch that is contained in the grain transforms itself into raw energy. And that energy basically takes the form of simple sugars. And those sugars is what draws then the yeast down into it. And because the yeast loves sugar. So now the yeast molecules are feeding and they're colonizing in these simple sugars on these simple sugars. And as that yeast grows and multiplies, they digest and release gas. And, of course, this is really hugely important in the process of making bread because at the same time, there are two protein components that are found in wheat that come together and they form this highly structured, highly evolved protein chain that we all call gluten. And gluten, from the point of view of a bread baker, is like a membrane that acts to capture gases released by the yeast molecules. And once that happens, then you have expansion. And at that point, you have the basic characteristics of bread dough.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, as bakers, all we really have to do is mine this process. We basically watch it unfold. And we do, we do as much as we can to ensure that the cultures are healthy and that the yeast molecules and enzymes are coexisting and they're not working at cross purposes or over-fermenting. And then we do add a small amount of salt for the purpose of creating stronger electrostatic bonds within the dough. And then from there, we use our hands, we shape and stretch and round this dough into loaves, and then we proof them. And that's when we put them in a warm, moist environment where that yeast just goes crazy. And ideally, then the dough rises and the structure holds. And as soon as we see that, that's when we get that bread in the oven and we hope it comes out perfectly. But it's really that simple. It's sprout of wheat, water, salt. That's our recipe. Everything else that other bakers add to make bread, we say is already there. You don't really need flour to make bread. You don't really need yeast. You don't need to add reactive enzymes, dough enhancers, flavor profiles, any of that, or preservatives, of course. Everything we need is there for us to work with. And if nature is cooperating, you know, all things are kind of lining up nicely, we feel you can make a pretty damn good loaf of bread. But that's why I say I think that wheat is a miraculous food source. If you want to attack industrial food stuff, you know, the garbage that holds your McDonald's hamburger together or your taco wrap or whatever or something that sits on a shelf for 6 weeks, I agree, that stuff is toxic, absolutely. And no way can I defend gluten when it is used as an industrial additive to all kinds of things that don't really need it, like ketchup and vitamin pills and, you know, you can have a list. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's a basis for a loaf of bread, a real loaf of bread. I don't think gluten is a problem. If you don't believe me, you can put our products to the test. And bear in mind, you know, we are individuals making food for other individuals, so it's not coming off a warehouse.
I got to say, too, that, I mean, you know, there's a reason why they call bread the staff of life, you know? It has been the staff of life for most of our history as a species, at least as a civilized species. And so my feeling is like, well, okay, then for thousands of years we got along fine without gluten-free bread. Okay, so why is it now suddenly a problem? Why are so many people supposedly, intolerant of gluten? And to me it makes sense that there's something that is in these modern breads that is not kind of like being done right, you know what I mean? And it sounds like you're doing it the right way, and if you're doing it the right way, it shouldn't be a problem. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we're careful who we source our wheat from. We do a lot of farmer markets, and we get to know different farmers, and when we find farmers that are growing grain, we talk to them, we see what they have, we test it. And one of the nice things about sprouting grain is that you identify that it is a viable grain. Because what's happening to a lot of the grain that goes into the industrial process is that they're utilizing something called pre-harvest burn down, which is where they basically spray the entire field with glyphosate. And bear in mind, wheat is not GMO, so what they're doing is they're killing the wheat. And the idea behind that is basically I think they just kind of want to get a baseline on their harvest and maybe beat a rainstorm or whatever. But and what's interesting there too is that, you know, I've looked at websites where farmers communicate with other farmers, and they always warn each other, look, if you're going to do a pre-harvest burn down, just don't forget to save a portion of your grain for next year's harvest, because if you spray it all, it's all going to be dead. And you know,
it won't sprout, right? It won't.
Yeah,
it can't grow anything.
It won't germinate, right?
Yeah.
So, I suppose, you know, if you're an industrial baker and you're working with flour, you don't care. I mean, you know, you're going to pulverize that grain anyway. You don't care if it's alive or not. But when you take the grain and you sprout it, you can verify that, hey, you know, this is a viable grain. It hasn't been sprayed. It's what we want to work with. And I think that there's other aspects to doing it right as well. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with, there's a bread out there called Dave's Killer Bread. I think it's out of Oregon, maybe it's Pacific Northwest. He's very successful. This was a guy who was an ex-con. He got into making bread. Great story. He liked to hire other ex-cons. And his business grew. And he, you know, he had a commendable, high-quality product. I've watched where he's gone, and he's used this, I think, what you would call a very standard vertical method to grow your business, and that is where you expand production, you grow your sales, you expand production, you grow your sales, you get on that chain, and until you achieve profitability, and as you get bigger and bigger and bigger, you hopefully get big enough to the point where the bigger guys notice you, and that's exactly what happened at Dave's Killer Bread. He just sold his company to a much bigger company that, you know, will now take over and continue to increase that. I mean, but But I think there's a problem with that model, and it rests entirely on achieving scales of production that, you know, expand every step along the way until you achieve profitability. And I know I'm sounding very much like a business person here, but I think I've thought a lot about this and how do we approach our growth. But what happens is you have to invest more and more money, and it's usually borrowed money, into new equipment that's, you know,
right,
incredibly costly, and by definition it's more efficient. And by the same token, you're going to want to reduce your labor costs. So you're eliminating bread bakers at some point because it's just much simpler, cheaper to hire people to mine machines. Because at a certain point, you know, machines are going to be doing everything. But, you know, let's be honest, at that point, it may look like a quality product, but you're no longer making,
in
the process of making a product by individuals for other individuals. It's an industrial commodity. And, you know, you have to take, you're under such stress to pay back those loans that got you to this point that I think you have a compromised product. So anyway, when I look at the idea of how do we grow, how do we look at another way of growth, I don't want to fall in that trap. So I sort of see us potentially expanding via a model I call horizontal growth. And by that, I mean something maybe like franchising. That is, in essence,
right,
we'd be looking for other bakers or non-bakers. I mean, after all, I don't have a pedigree as a baker. But people who maybe want to adopt our model and are looking at bread in the way we do, partnering with nature. People who will do as we do and source their grains as much as possible from local farmers, and who will offer an opportunity for employees to get a stake in their business. And in that way, I can see us growing this business across the landscape of small towns and cities without ever having to sacrifice the quality or the human touch, which I think is really important.
Michael
Prokovich once described this idea as a Lilliputian solution, which is to say small success stories spread out over an entire landscape that would then offer the most people a path to personal financial security, which also sort of works to strengthen their local economy, creates a new vitality within their community, and it all centers around this centuries old tradition of every town and village having a baker at its core. I mean, I firmly believe that the future of this country right now is in the small towns all over America that have been left to wither and die by these Walmart big box stores, the vertical model. And they ultimately closed down most, if not all, you know, the family-owned businesses
that made this
a great country and in favor of a bunch of crap that got chipped over from China. So, I don't know. I feel like if we can return our vitality to small town America. And I do think it's happening. I mean, if you haven't already noticed, you know, there's a lot of coffee roasters out there. There's a lot of micro brewers out there. And a lot of them are started up by young people who just want to strike out on their own and make a difference. But, you know, these small towns, I mean, I'm living in one of them. We no longer have a hardware store. You know, we no longer have a lot of basic businesses, a local pharmacist, all those things. And if they could all come back, it just would create so much wealth within a community. And again, I feel that the baker is one of those missing pieces. You know, for whatever reason, we've kind of overlooked the baker. But you put a real baker in the heart of a small town, and I'm not talking like the pizza shop or the
no,
donut, like,
not at all.
I mean, a real artisan baker.
It's true. I read a lot of history, and, you know, back in not that long ago, in 17th, 18th century, you look in Europe, every town had a baker. You know, it was like you had to. I mean, that's where people went to get their daily loaf. You know, that's what people lived on. And so
probably the first communal business created. I mean, everybody brought their grains in. Bakers would make it up. They get their own. They get to keep some for themselves, and you take home that portion. And to some extent, that's still true in much of Europe. You know, where you have bakers are. The product is individual to that area, you know, to the grain that's grown there. So I don't know why we can't do that again in this country.
Well, I think you got a great story. You have not only a great business model, but I think what you just described is sort of like a vision for a social revolution in a very important way. And I just think it's incredibly cool on lots and lots of different levels. Amazing story. A great job. And you make great products, by the way. So I want to tell everybody who's listening, plug your website once again, please, because people should know how to get your stuff. It's great.
Well, thanks, Lee. Yes, the website is ColumbiaCountyBred.com. In Columbia, I'll just mention real quickly, when we moved to Pennsylvania, it's a city called Columbia County, and I'm a bit of a Civil War buff. And Columbia, if you know this or not, but it was an ideal sort of Romanesque figure, a woman, that the founders created to sort of symbolize the district that they named after her. And she was there to symbolize this idea that, you know, this capital of this new country would be a place where people sought a higher ideal of governance. And, that was the idea. Didn't entirely work out that way, but Columbia, I think with the Civil War, the advent of the Civil War, she came on to represent the North. I just remember seeing her brandishing a sword. Helping to free slaves. And then after the Civil War, I think she might have come back into prominence, except for the Statue of Liberty came along and sort of usurped her presence. And now she's basically a movie studio icon. But
right.
I believe in that initial idea of what she stood to represent. And I just felt like, wow, I'm living in Columbia County. How great. So that's why we named this company after her.
A great way to punctuate the end of this fantastic story and a great interview. And Doug, thank you so much for being on, and I wish you tremendous success in everything you're doing. I hope your social revolution takes on.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to help too and support what you're doing with the Pure Plant Pure Nation. I mean, I think that it's something that we're thrilled to be involved in. And I do appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. Thank you so much.
Not a problem. Thank you again. And, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk again soon. Okay.